This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. From the moment the ink was dry on President Obama's Affordable Care Act, Republican lawmakers vowed to repeal it and replace it. From the start, they'd had a lot of concerns, and the ACA became law with no GOP votes. So now that the Republican Party dominates Washington, getting Obamacare off the books has been a key early priority. But while repeal is easy, replace is hard. Parts of the ACA are popular with the public, so some lawmakers lately seem more inclined to retain certain chunks of the law. However, doing that costs money, and most Republicans have disliked the taxes and the mandates associated with Obamacare. Today in The Exchange, a new prescription for the Affordable Care Act. It's part of NPR and NHPR's effort to look at the first 100 days of the White House and the State House. So let's hear from you this hour. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And we're going to begin with Dan Gorenstein, our former colleague at NHPR, our now senior reporter for Marketplace's Health Desk, and he joins us from Philadelphia. And Dan, great to have you back on the air with us. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Laura. Great to be back.
Well, walk us through this repeal and replace effort, Dan, please, and just start with President Trump. What has he done so far?
Sure. Well, so over the weekend, for those of you who weren't paying attention to the Patriots game.
Which is no one.
That's right. President Trump spoke with Bill O'Reilly on Fox and was asked about the Affordable Care Act in the future. And now something that the president has promised from the beginning is that they would move very quickly, that this is going to be a top priority, and that they're going to have a plan out, and they're going to repeal and replace Obamacare immediately. Over the weekend, he's really backed off that much more than he ever has before. He says he told Bill O'Reilly, quote, you know, this is very complicated. We're putting a wonderful plan into place. It's going to come out fairly soon. Fairly soon, though, he said, is by the end of the year, but we should have something within the year or the following year, he said. So I think, Laura, what really this signals is that, you know, you've got to give the Republicans credit. They do want to do something. They're really interested in doing something. And I think now that they have the full responsibility, they're quickly picking up just how difficult this is. A simple, like, repeal and replace immediately is, I think, seen as both politically and policy-wise, perhaps a little foolhardy. And so they're tapping the brakes, they're slowing down, and they're trying to really come up with a very serious plan here.
So the U.S. House has been looking at this for a long time, and during President Obama's tenure, you know, came up with bills repeatedly to repeal and replace. What sorts of ideas is the U.S. House looking at, and what are they up to now?
Well, so last week, the House held several hearings. There were a couple on Medicaid. There was one on guaranteeing coverage for people with pre-existing conditions. And it seems like that there's a real desire to begin to get into the nitty-gritty. There are huge policy implications in the Affordable Care Act. I mean, when it's been such a political football, it's sort of easy to get distracted by what the Affordable Care Act is. But in one sense, what it really is, in my mind, is it's really sort of reconceiving and rewriting some basic rules around what insurance is, what it's not, and what it's not. And I think we saw last week the House begin to, like, tease out what they're trying to do, how you define insurance, what people are guaranteed, what they're not guaranteed. And then also this huge question, which I know you talk about, the state house in Concord, Medicaid and Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act, and also, you know, maybe potentially going to a block grant kind of situation. There are lots of moving parts, and the House really began to wrestle with some of those thorny issues last week.
Well, and a little bit later in our program, we'll have two state senators on who have looked at this Medicaid issue from each side of it, expand or not expand. What about the U.S. Senate, Dan? Is it pretty much the House and President Trump now, or are they getting involved as well?
No. I mean, you know, look, certainly it's both chambers and Congress. There's no doubt. One of the interesting things, this is not exclusive to the Senate, but there was sort of a shift in language a little bit from some members on the backside of a major meeting Republicans had several weeks ago in Philadelphia. You started to hear high-ranking members of Congress, both the House and the Senate, talk about repairing Obamacare or fixing Obamacare rather than just repeal and replace. Now, what that means exactly is anybody's guess, but it does. It's sort of a softening of the language. I mean, we for so many years with the Republicans, we heard this very, very heated rhetoric, and I think you're beginning to see that modify itself. And the pressure's heating up, right? Some of these members of Congress are going to their home districts and they're meeting with people, or meeting with constituents, and people are outraged and they're being chanted down and sometimes overrun in these meetings. And I think that there's a real recognition on the part of Republicans in Congress that there's a lot of fear and consternation. And so, again, people are slowing down. People are trying to, like, Republicans are trying to figure out how to package this, how to manage this, and how to really tackle it.
So that's the politics. Let's talk a little bit, Dan, about policy, and then we've got two guests for the hour who will dig into it more. But just remind us first, Dan, what the key elements were of the Affordable Care Act. There are like three or four sort of big chunks that made this what it was.
Right. So one big chunk is you want to expand insurance, and so the federal government under the Affordable Care Act expanded Medicaid to include people up to 138% of poverty. So previously, in most states, the only people who could have Medicaid would be people who had children and were very poor and the disabled. This opened that up. You didn't have to have a child anymore. You could make a little bit of income. This would apply to lots of people in New Hampshire, for example, who have seasonal work but not consistent year-round work. So they've got some money, they're working, but they don't have that full-time kind of job. And so those people now all of a sudden had access to insurance. That was one group.
Medicaid expansion. Okay, go ahead.
Medicaid expansion, that's right. And then another thing is the under the Affordable Care Act, people were given subsidies, money to help them purchase insurance on either a state-based exchange or the federal healthcare.gov exchange. Basically, you could think of it kind of like Expedia for buying plane tickets, where you can go and you can shop around and look for insurance coverage. And the idea there was to help people afford the monthly premiums. And then really you've got the mandate. You've got the mandate in place, which requires people for the first time to have insurance. And if they do not have that insurance, the federal government is going to be able to fine you. Now, arguably, that fine was not effective enough. But those are key building blocks. But I must say, Laura, one absolute essential piece to the Affordable Care Act that I think doesn't get the attention it deserves is that our nation spends a lot of money on health care. And maybe that's fine, but we spend so much money, and the outcomes, the quality we get is sort of middle of the road compared to other countries. And what the Affordable Care Act was saying is it was a signal to say, look, we need to do things differently. We need to figure out how to get waste out of the system. We need to figure out how to get more quality out of the system. And in lots of ways, your other guests are going to be able to talk about over and over, is lots of signals trying to shake up, you know, hospitals, pharmaceutical companies, insurance companies, and even consumer behavior and employers, and really try to move us in a new direction. So there's a paradigm shift
in terms of costs of care, never mind insurance, but the actual costs of care that lead to those higher rates, Dan.
That's right.
Well,
exactly.
What are some of the main healthcare ideas that you're hearing about now? And you can just give us a couple headlines, Dan. You don't need to go into great detail, but
Sure. Just
some of the key ideas that you're hearing coming out of the Republican Party now that they've got the keys to the kingdom, so to speak.
Right. Well, one of your guests, Jim Capretti, he's written about this. He's gonna have excellent things to say. Your guests are in for a treat. You've got some great guests coming up on the rest of the show. But one of the key things that I've heard is this real desire to go to a very high deductible health plan. You know, President Trump and other key Republicans have talked about there really is need to be insurance for all. Now, what's insurance for all going to look like? How is that managed? I mean, that's one of the million-dollar questions, but it seems like one of the driving desires is to have people on these very high deductible $5,000, $7,000, $10,000 deductible plans, sort of catastrophic insurance. And, you know, that's one key concept. And arguably, those are going to be cheaper to afford on the front end with the premium. And then you're also going to have, they want to expand health savings accounts so people can keep more of their own money and use money that they've got sort of squirreled away to help meet that deductible. Now, whether or not that's going to be very popular with people, I'm not sure. There's been a lot of folks who've been criticizing the Affordable Care Act for out-of-pocket exposure. And I think we're really at an inflection point here, Laura, where our leaders, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, are trying to wrestle with the cost of care when lots of consumers, lots of voters are saying, we don't want to spend that much for our care, but we want a lot of it. So that's the tension, and that's one of the things Republicans are going to have to navigate over the next 12 months.
Well, Dan, keep an eye on this for us, would you please? Because we'll be checking in again with you.
I will. Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Take care.
Thanks. Bye.
That's Dan Gorenstein. He's senior reporter for Marketplace's Health Desk. Today in the Exchange, a new prescription for the Affordable Care Act, what that might look like. Join us with your questions and comments as we look at the Republican Party's effort to repeal and replace the ACA. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our guests for the hour are Lucy Hodder, Director of Health Policy, Health Law and Policy, and a professor at UNH Law. She most recently served as legal counsel and senior health policy director for Governor, now Senator Maggie Hassan. And Lucy Hodder, welcome back to The Exchange. Nice to see you.
Thank you, Laura. Nice to be here.
Also joining us by phone, Jim Capretta, a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he holds the Milton Friedman Chair and studies healthcare, entitlement programs, U.S. budgetary policy. Jim Capretta, really nice to have you, too. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, Lucy, I'll turn to you first. How do you view this idea of repeal and replace? What does that bring up for you?
Well, I think that it's been pretty quick that everyone's realized repeal and replace really needs to be looking at repair. You know, where are we? What have we accomplished? Everyone needs to remember that the most basic essence of the Affordable Care Act was implemented in 2014, where the, you know, fundamental promise, which was everyone should have coverage, began to take its place. And so now we're at a point where, okay, it's 2017. What does that coverage look like? And we're still grappling with the questions of, did we cover the right people? In this case, it was everybody. What kind of coverage should everyone have? And how should we pay for it? And I think those are ongoing questions. Have we done it right? So if you look at least what we've accomplished, in New Hampshire, there was 11% of our population who did not have insurance in 2010, and now it's down to 6.3%. We have coverage opportunities at every level. It's comprehensive coverage. I guess the question we still are grappling with is how do we make it more affordable? And that really is an all-in, everybody-at-the-table conversation.
What do you think, Jim? A lot of words have been thrown around. Dan mentioned some of them. You know, repeal, replace, and then some people are now saying, how about repair? How about retain certain parts of the law? How about refresh part of the law? I mean, what do you think about repeal and replace, Jim?
Well, I'd say that for the Republicans who are now in positions of power, their ambition really ought to be, how do they want to change healthcare and make it better for the country? I mean, this is their opportunity. This is even different from when President Reagan came into office or President Bush. They didn't really run on healthcare. This group of people who are now in policy positions ran on trying to do something very different in healthcare, and now they're in a position to do so. So their ambition, I think, needs to be, what do we want to do to move healthcare in a really market-oriented direction where it will improve and bring better services to people over time? That's a complicated thing. It's a big deal. But I think if they put their ambition and energy into that, then they have a chance to do something pretty significant.
Well,
With respect to the Affordable Care Act, I'd say a couple things. Number one, it didn't cover everybody. There's about 29 million people, according to the Census Bureau, who were uninsured in 2015. There's a large number of people that are exempting themselves out of the system, largely because they find the products unattractive on the exchanges. Approximately 10 million or so people have exempted themselves from the individual mandate for a number of reasons, and another several million people paid the tax instead of buying insurance. Moreover, there's a lot of people that are eligible for various coverage and haven't enrolled yet. So to say that it provided coverage for everybody in the United States, I don't think is accurate, actually.
So I want to ask you, Jim, about something you mentioned on reliance on private markets, and let's get a more market-oriented approach. That seems to me one aspect of the Affordable Care Act that helped it become law, right? Because, you know, it was still based in the private marketplace. They weren't blowing things up completely. But then it seemed to also cause difficulties, Jim, that, you know, private markets do what they want. They don't necessarily do what the president or the Congress wants. So I wonder what you think about that, the sort of benefits and pitfalls of relying on private markets.
Well, this is a really important question. I mean, most countries in the world don't rely on private markets in health very much. They really rely on regulatory and governmental action. And I think a big part of what's going on here in our debate, underlying debate in the United States, is that it's true that President Obama and others have said that they relied on private insurance and relied on the private market to try to deliver this package. But the truth is much power was moved to the federal government through the Affordable Care Act, both over the insurance system as well as the delivery of care structure. And the federal government is really now calling the shots in a lot of ways. Now, we can debate whether that's a good or a bad idea, but I think there's a lot of folks who think over time, not necessarily very much in the near term, but maybe 10 or 15 or 20 years from now, if the federal government is trying to control and run everything, that is a different kind of approach that may lead to a different kind of innovation in the United States healthcare, a different kind of adaptation, and maybe a diminishment in the quality and progress that could be made if we allowed for more private action and activity.
What do you think, Lucy?
Well, I just think that's a little bit of a loaded term, although I understand that Jim's point is we have to have everybody trying to figure out what they're purchasing, how it works for them, and really understand. But this is insurance. This is not a private market. It's an insurance risk pool market that we're talking about. And even employers where, you know, 66% of us get our coverage have had a hard time trying to figure out what they're purchasing and how to move the system to a place that it's comprehensible and affordable. So really, if you push it to a private market system, you've got to say, okay, what tools are we giving employers and individuals who now have a huge amount of risk on them to actually make sense of the healthcare they're purchasing? And, you know, the federal government, for better or for worse, has tried to, through the Affordable Care Act, push things in a number of ways. First of all, the Medicare. There was a lot of reform in Medicare, and Medicare is actually the projections of savings is substantially better than where we were in 2009, where Medicare was skyrocketing into the stratosphere of a potential burden on all of us. So payment reform efforts and really trying to look at our populations and use our data to figure out where are the needs and how can we address them most efficiently have really made some real progress. And then you also have individuals who are now trying to a little bit more aware because they're supposed to have coverage, a little bit more aware of what they're purchasing and how they can make those decisions. Employers are really coming to the table and starting to say, okay, how are we going to manage our risk pool? How are we going to look at wellness programs? Covering mental health and substance use is very important in our community in New Hampshire and employers making sure they have healthy employees and using their coverage comprehensively has made a big difference. So I don't think saying private market will solve all problems is realistic. At the same time, we have in New Hampshire instituted a real public-private partnership around our coverage.
With Medicaid expansion.
Exactly, with Medicaid
especially.
Coverage in the marketplaces.
Well, and coming up in a minute, we'll talk to Republican State Senator Andy Sanborn. He's long been critical of the ACA. We'll hear his ideas for healthcare in New Hampshire, and we'll hear from you. Keep those emails coming, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. More in a minute. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a new prescription for the Affordable Care Act. With Republicans on track to repeal this law, what will they replace it with, and how much will it look like the original? Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like, NHPR Exchange. We have two guests for the hour. Lucy Hodder is here, Director of Health Law and Policy, and a professor at UNH Law. She most recently served as legal counsel and senior health policy director for then-Governor, now-Senator, Maggie Hassan. Also with us from D.C., Jim Capretta, a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he holds the Milton Friedman Chair and studies healthcare, entitlement programs, and U.S. budget policy. And both of you now joining us on the phone is Republican State Senator Andy Sanborn. He's from Bedford. He's long been an opponent of New Hampshire's Medicaid expansion approach. And Senator Sanborn, welcome back to the Exchange. Good to have you.
Laura, good morning. Thank you so much for having me. And Lucy and Jim, thanks for having me on the show today.
Well, we really appreciate it. I'm sure, given that you own a sports bar, you had a late night last night, so we really appreciate you being with us. So how do you feel, Senator Sanborn, about this idea of repeal and replace?
You know, I think it's a great idea. You know, clearly, Laura, there's no question that the Affordable Care Act and its subsidy and small brother, the Medicaid expansion, clearly has not been as successful as anyone thought or hoped it would be. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons for it, from high costs to get in, the high minimum standards, the fact that people are, as many people can't afford it as want to get onto it. I mean, clearly, this is a failed program that really is ripe to let the legislature come back and take a look at it, and I would encourage that they would.
So failed program in what sense, Senator Sanborn? Because there have been parts of this that, you know, people like.
Absolutely. I mean, and again, let's be clear, because I don't want us to speak in a vacuum. You can always find something good and something bad in everything. But holistically, at the end of the day, I think we need to look and say, has the implementation of the Affordable Care Act made the cost of insurance higher or lower? And by every stretch, it's higher. It's made co-pays higher. It's made deductibles higher. It's made co-insurance higher. We continue to see a reduction in the accessibility of health care. And I think part of the most important part, Laura, at this point, is today there's become such a divide in the access to what type of insurance you're getting. Because as you know, most large companies and all the self-funded plans have been totally exempt from all the requirements that small companies and, more importantly, individuals have been subjected to under the Affordable Care Act. So it's made a real strong, deep divide in access and cost of health insurance. And that, at its core, is where I think we need to start.
Now, the cost of premiums, never mind the deductibles and the copays, but the cost of insurance premiums, as I understand, Senator Sanborn, haven't gone up very much in New Hampshire compared to other states.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, Laura, you have to understand, for everyday hardworking people, the cost of the premium is one of the four components, or five if you include access, of what people have to pay. So sure, you know, through government intervention, they've been able to manipulate the cost of the monthly insurance plan, but the co-pays, deductibles, and co-insurances, where, you know, 4 years ago, people could get health insurance for $700 a month for a family with a $500 copay. Granted, that plan under the exchanges might now be $900, which is up, but their copays or deductibles are $5,000 to $12,000. So you have to look at the thing holistically of the total cost of someone's health care and get away from that political aspect of saying, well, just the monthly insurance premium amount is X and has risen by Y.
About 50,000 Granite Staters now get insurance due to Medicaid expansion. 53,000 get insurance off the exchanges set up by the ACA, many with subsidies to afford it. So what options would you like to see, Senator Sanborn, in a replacement to offer those Granite Staters coverage, altogether more than 100,000 citizens?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first and foremost, we know that there is no federal Department of Insurance. It's one of those things when people talk about what could the federal government get rid of, if it's the SBA or the Department of Education. There's never been a Department of Insurance, and this is the government's first attempt of trying to take it over. Clearly, Laura, it needs to come back to the states. Let's bring all the regulation and the plan construction and the decisions of how we make sure people have good access to health care back at the state level. So I'd love to see them block grant the money and send it back to us. In addition to that, I think we need to continue to bring those free market principles you know I talk about to really allow real competition to happen. We have to remember the cost of healthcare in New Hampshire specifically is now the highest in the country. Let's get some competition in here. Let's get more and better medical facilities, Let's get better transparency to see what it's really costing for people to get health care. And let's make sure that all the advantages being given to large self-funded plans that have been exempt, that everyday people should have that same ability to go do that. For example, you know, individual low-cost, high-deductible, catastrophic plans should come back. Because at the end of the day, Laura, if we really believe this is insurance, it's about widening the pool. So we have to find a product to allow people to come in at whatever level they want to be there and hopefully not utilize it, so the pool has the resources to help those that are in need.
The catastrophic health plans, we're going to hear a lot about that this hour, Senator Sanborn. One criticism of those has been that they leave people underinsured, that except for a car accident or a broken leg, people don't get regular care. Consequently, they're less healthy. They're not doing that sort of regular maintenance that they should. I wonder what you think about the openings that catastrophic care leaves when you take a broad look at what it means to stay healthy for the individual.
I mean, Laura, I mean, honestly, I think the first thing you need to think about is what Jim had said a minute ago, that he said something like 29 million people in America have no insurance still. So do you want to give them the ability to have some sort of insurance that meets their financial needs and ability, or nothing? Because that's where we are right now. Just think how much stronger the market would be and the insurance pools would be if those 29 million people, and I think you said there was an additional 10 million who chose not to buy, if they all bought some form of insurance because there was a free market plan that they could A, afford, and B, met their needs. That there's only upside to that, Laura. There is no downside because today those people have no insurance whatsoever.
I got one more question for you, Senator Sanborn. And again, we appreciate your time. Here's an email from Karina, which talks about two elements of the Affordable Care Act that do seem to have broad popularity in the public. So let me read this to you, please. It's Karina in Dover says, my daughter was diagnosed over 2 years ago with type 1 diabetes. Right now, she is covered under health insurance through my work, but I'm concerned about what might happen if the protection for pre-existing conditions and the ability to cover her until she's 26 goes away. I'm also concerned that when she turns 26, she's still going to need affordable, high-quality health care. Those seem to be, Senator Sanborn, two of the most popular elements of the Affordable Care Act that, you know, just doesn't sit right with people, that a health insurance company can turn someone away because they have some condition. And a lot of people love that, insuring young people up until 26. So I wonder if you would, if you were in charge, include those two elements in a replacement plan.
Laura, thanks for the question. I asked that way. Hey, one thing I love about New Hampshire is we have always believed in taking care of our people in this state. So you know that in New Hampshire, we had already passed requirements years ago to make sure that the insurance companies couldn't kick people off if they were between or couldn't deny people that were sick. So if we send insurance back to each individual state, in New Hampshire, as you see, we've already provided that. So your listener who wrote in would still be covered, as would her daughter. Now, honestly, I hope that by the time someone's 26 years old, that they would have graduated college and done well and had a great job and be able to afford to have their own insurance off and move out of their parents' house. But I think that's probably a discussion for a show at a later date.
Well, Senator Sanborn, we will talk to you later about this, I'm sure, as the legislative season continues. But I'll let you go right now, okay?
Awesome. Thank you so much for the time. I truly appreciate weighing in.
Thank you. That's Senator Andy Sanborn, Republican from Bedford. You can join us, too. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. And before we go back to our listeners, Jim Capretta, your thoughts on some of the themes that we heard from Senator Sanborn there?
Well, I think it's very interesting that a state legislature really wants to move forward with taking proactive control and move ahead with their own ideas on how to reform health care. I think that's probably true in a lot of states around the country. One of the big complaints, I think, about the Affordable Care Act is it's got this sense of the federal government dictating to the states and to lots of people that here's what you got to buy under these circumstances. It's very constrained and constricting. And it's quite true that the Affordable Care Act did insure a lot more people through the Medicaid expansion and through the subsidies in the exchanges. But there's also a large number of people that are not happy with the choices that are available, and they can't really get out of it because of the restrictions of the ACA. And so I think some balance between trying to put the pressure on insurance premiums to make sure everybody can get coverage, but allowing enough flexibility so that the products are attractive is going to have to be rebalanced to some degree, and probably a lot of that is going to happen at the state level.
Well, and let's talk about that, Lucy, a little bit, because that has been a big complaint, that the federal government said, you know, we don't want insurance companies to offer skimpy insurance because then people feel underinsured and they have ugly surprises when they end up in the hospital. Every time we talked about the ACA when it first rolled out, we got a call from a gentleman on the Seacoast who said, look, I'm not going to have a baby. You know, he was, whatever his life situation was, he was very sure he was not going to have a baby. And yet he said under the ACA, he had to have coverage that included maternity coverage, even though he was 100% sure he was not going to bring a child into his life. So those are the type of stories that bolster what Jim says. Like, why do people have to buy that comprehensive coverage and they're pretty darn sure they're not going to need it?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I think it's important to remember, again, 2014, we had one carrier on the marketplace. Now we have, then we were up to five, and now we have four. The premiums have stabilized. There's a continuity of coverage now so that, in fact, our premium rates are not going up as high as they were, and actually our out-of-pocket contributions are not going up as high as they were. And two-thirds of the people on the marketplace plans have federal support. So it's important to remember that the people who are completely out-of-pocket for their premium and all their deductibles on the marketplace are about 18 to 20,000 in New Hampshire overall. And yes, they really are pushing. And some of them are sole proprietors, and they're really pushing for a little bit more choice as to what they purchase. And it's easy to sympathize with that. But remember, the vast number of people who are insured in New Hampshire have some kind of federal support. I think people forget that even employees who are have insurance through employer groups are federally subsidized through the tax exemption that employers have. So we all have some level of support to make sure we can access coverage. The real problem is, what is around for someone to buy if they're left with that decision? Is there coverage? Are we really doing what we need to follow through on the payment reform, on really the coordination with the providers as well to make sure we're purchasing value? Are we able to use what Senator Sanborn says about transparency? Are we really accessing the data? Are we ensuring we have public access to the data? Because, you know, when we talk about the federal government coming in, New Hampshire has done a lot to make sure it can access important data, and that's been somewhat thwarted recently at the Supreme Court around our public database. So there certainly are efforts to try and do that. Now, remember also that if we all are trying to purchase coverage and we don't all have mental health support, substance use support, maternity, reproductive health, et cetera, then there are real gaps in the care we will receive. And so New Hampshire—
Someone who's pretty sure they're never going to have a kid.
Absolutely. So the question is, are we all in it together as a community, or are we in it for ourselves? And that's a hard decision to make. I think in New Hampshire, we've seen how important the substance use and mental health coverage has been, especially in an opioid epidemic. And we've been able to, because of the Affordable Care Act and because of the coverage for substance use, actually bring providers into insurance, make substance use treatment available, and allow the number of individuals in New Hampshire who've never had access to treatment before get it. So that's one place, I think, where as everybody having that kind of access to coverage has allowed us to really make some headway on our substance use issues in New Hampshire.
One of the big issues that keeps coming up in any type of replacement package, Lucy, is these catastrophic healthcare plans or high deductible plans where, you know, again, you're 28 years old, you're basically healthy, you get in a car accident, you're covered. How do you feel about those plans?
Well, you know what? I think that we've seen those all along. So they were certainly something that was happening in spades before the Affordable Care Act. We had a little bit of reprieve, and certainly there is out-of-pocket. I think some people see out-of-pocket skin in the game as a way to get consumers engaged in what they're purchasing. I think we've seen the New Hampshire Health Cost website really step up to both provide information about costs as well as quality. And if no one has looked at it, go to the New Hampshire Cost website because you can see what things cost. And individuals are really making choices. The critical thing, though, is who is going to make sure that they're actually providers, you know, providing value at lower cost in our community. We're seeing a lot of consolidation amongst providers. We don't have much regulation or oversight. Maybe we don't want it. Competition can help. But remember, we also fully fund preventative care. Do we really want competition and out-of-pocket competition when we're going to internal medicine and pediatrics, which are the lowest paid providers in our community? So we really do need to be careful when we talk about bringing competition. Some is good. Individuals and employers who are making some choices around cost when they have access to information can really help our system improve to become more efficient. But we've got to understand value, understand cost, and really help educate everybody on what they're purchasing.
Well, Senator Sanborn talked about Medicaid block grants, and I know this is another big idea that we're going to hear a lot about in the coming months. So, Jim Capretta, just remind us how this is different from the current system.
Well, Medicaid, since its enactment, has been paid for and financed between a federal and state partnership, with the federal government paying what they call a matching rate, averaging at about 60% across all the states. So when a state spends $1 on a Medicaid program, the federal government's paying roughly for 60 or 65 cents of that dollar. So it's called a matching system. When you do it that way, which has been done since the enactment of the program, it creates a little bit of a distorted incentive system. You know, you have state legislators who can expand the program, and it only costs their own taxpayers maybe 33, 35 cents on the dollar. And the federal government, because it's spending so much in a matching system, by the way, with no limit, it kind of feels impelled and entitled to impose a lot of rules on the Medicaid program. So you have a bifurcated financing system, which leads to bifurcated political accountability and responsibility. Frankly, neither the federal government nor the states really feel like they're totally in charge. It creates a lot of resentment and a lot of finger-pointing. The block grant, which I actually don't favor, I'd rather have a per capita payment system, but both of them are trying to move away from the matching system. In other words, try to say from the federal government to the states, here's a fixed amount of money, either in total or per-person basis, and you, the states, will have a much more flexibility to manage those costs best. So you don't get additional dollars when you spend more, but for the dollars that we give you, you're going to have a lot less rules controlling what you do with it. States, I think, most governors and many are going to say, we like that. I think at the end of the day, they'd like to move it with some guarantees and assurances about it, but I think there's going to be a movement to say, let's, in exchange for a little bit more fixed financing from the federal government, the states will have a lot more flexibility.
So it sounds like a block grant. Is the only difference that, you know, if all of a sudden 5% more of the population comes onto Medicaid, there would be funding available for that? Is that the only difference, Jim?
Well, that's a big difference. And it also, you could have per capita payments based on eligibility groups. So Medicaid is actually really a very diverse program with three or four very distinct populations participating in it with very different needs and different care arrangements. So you could have a per capita payment for the elderly poor who are dually eligible for Medicare. You could have a per capita payment for the disabled and one for the able-bodied and children.
Well, coming up, Republican Senator Jeb Bradley, one of the forces behind New Hampshire's own Medicaid expansion program, will join us with his thoughts on repeal and replace. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a new prescription for the Affordable Care Act. Republicans want to repeal it, but what will they replace it with? We're finding out more. It's part of NPR and NHPR's effort to look at the first 100 days of the White House and the State House. The Exchange number for you to join us with your questions, comments, concerns, 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Lucy Hodder, Jim Capretta, we talked a moment ago with Republican State Senator Andy Sanborn. Joining us by phone now is Republican State Senator Jeb Bradley. He's the majority leader in our state Senate and one of the architects of the state's Medicaid expansion program. And Senator Bradley, welcome back. Always good to have you.
Good morning, Laura. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Just remind us why you felt like it was so important that New Hampshire jump into this Medicaid expansion program under the Affordable Care Act.
Well, a couple of things. I think themes of your show, the biggest problem with the Affordable Care Act is that it has not created affordable care. The cost of health care keeps going up because technology improves, and we all want access to help, you know, save our lives. That's one big issue. And I think another thing is that you've got the younger, healthier people. Folks who designed the Affordable Care Act thought they would flock to the program in droves. They haven't. And so the cost basis has shifted to providing care for unhealthier people. Now, all that being said, I think Medicaid expansion in New Hampshire has worked very well. And it's good to talk with Lucy, because Lucy, myself, and a number of other people really worked to create the public-private partnership. It has increased competition among insurance carriers in the state. It has insured 50,000 people that didn't have access to Medicaid traditional, or it would not have qualified for the Affordable Care Act subsidies. And they have improved health outcomes. And I think that's something very, very important as we discuss it. Could it be improved? Could we, as Mr. Capretta said, with a block grant, greater flexibility from Washington, design a program that is more effective as well as being more cost efficient? And I think the answer is yes, we could. I mean, for instance, people like myself fought for work requirements in our Medicaid expansion program. They were rejected by the Obama administration. There ought to be some kind of an asset test. There ought to be more personal responsibility in Medicaid expansion. And so I think that if states had more flexibility, you'd get a lot of innovation. And all of us, I think, want to make sure that we have access to affordable health care for everybody in this country, and certainly in New Hampshire. But the, you know, with all the rules and a top-heavy system, that hasn't always been accomplished.
So Medicaid expansion, again, you were a big fan. You helped create New Hampshire's unique approach. Sounds like you would be okay, Senator Bradley, with block grants for Medicaid expansion.
I would. And I chair the commission that was created in the last reauthorization in 2016. And I told, you know, everybody, let's take a time out. Let's put the politics aside for a while. Let's just be practical and see what opportunities come out of Washington, and then react to that. Will there be block grants? Will there be something like Mr. Capretta talks about, with, you know, grants on an individual basis, so to speak, for states to use? So what's the funding flow, and what's the what are the rules? And I think that, you know, on a bipartisan basis, and the Medicaid expansion that I've worked on has always been bipartisan, we've had experts in healthcare like Lucy, who's done a great job of, you know, trying to coalesce the different things that we need to touch base on to design something. But I think, you know, with more flexibility, we could design something that still has great access, but becomes more affordable.
Well, so again, hoping to work and improve Medicaid expansion, but keep it in some form. What about the exchanges, Senator Bradley, where 52,000 Granite Staters have bought health insurance on these exchanges? Some, as Lucy pointed out, many with generous federal subsidies to help them afford that coverage. How do you feel about that aspect of the Affordable Care Act, Senator Bradley?
Well, I think this is where it's become, you know, less affordable. I think Medicaid expansion for those states that have done it has worked pretty well. Certainly in New Hampshire's case, it has. But I think that moving toward options that have higher deductible plans, health savings accounts, your guests have not talked about the ability to purchase health insurance across state lines. That's something that would become more consumer-driven. In order to make healthcare more affordable, it has to become more consumer-driven. So bill transparency is vital. Everybody who is a consumer of healthcare ought to know what, you know, what they're facing, because then they make rational decisions. And I think that we need to fund things like community health centers that offer access to affordable care, but at a quality, with a quality, I mean, that's at an affordable price. And I think these are things, as well as possibly reforming the tax code so you get first dollar benefit for health expenses would make healthcare more consumer-driven. That would enhance personal responsibility, because at the end of the day, we are responsible for the decisions that we make in our healthcare, and giving those kind of consumer signals is something that we haven't done. That's the biggest failure, I think, of the Affordable Care Act. There were insurance forms that absolutely needed to be made. We needed to guarantee access. We needed to have a more community-driven rating system so that, older people had the pyramid of younger people helping to create affordable health care. These were things that New Hampshire had done a long time ago. The 26-year-old issue, I think those all need to be retained, but can we drive down the cost of health care by making it more consumer-driven? And so I think, that's what, folks in Washington are having to debate. And, I think it's going to take some time. This is 1/6 of the national economy is healthcare.
That's a lot, yeah.
It doesn't happen overnight.
Well, Senator Bradley, again, we'll be checking back in on this with you. Thank you very much for your time right now. We appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Laura. Thank you.
Thank you. That's Senator Jeb Bradley, Republican Majority Leader in the New Hampshire State Senate, and as we said, one of the architects of the state's Medicaid expansion program. And boy, Jim Caprette and Lucy Hodder, so much more we could talk about. Jim, to you first. Senator Bradley made the point that one of the problems with the Affordable Care Act is the Obama administration made the assumption that young people would say, hooray, I can finally get coverage. And instead, a lot of them said, no thanks. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, I mean, they did a couple of things in the law that run counter to being a good deal for people that are healthy and younger. One would be that they put in a requirement that there would be a limitation on how much older people pay relative to young people of 3-to-1, which is probably unnatural relative to the cost structure that's typical. In other words, it might be closer to 5-to-1 or more in terms of the average spend for someone in their 50s versus someone in their 20s. And so when you narrow it to 3-to-1, you raise the premiums on young people and you lower them from older people. But by definition, that means that some of the younger people are not going to find it as attractive. The second thing that's important to understand is that if you're below about 250% of the federal poverty line, then they're providing pretty generous subsidies to enroll in the exchanges. But if you're above that amount, you're working, you're a moderate income person, and you're making $40,000 or $50,000 a year, and you got to buy your insurance on the exchanges, and you're trying to make ends meet, the premiums are going to be quite high, and the deductible is quite high. So you could have a $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 insurance premium and a $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 deductible before you ever get any coverage for health services. So for that kind of family, they're going to say, gee whiz, this doesn't seem like that great of a deal for me. The ACA put a lot of resources into the lowest income households and people with very high expenses, people with pre-existing conditions. But for people that were working, trying to pay their own bills and trying to cover their own premiums, it turned out to be not that great of a deal. And I think that's a lot of why there's been some political instability around the law.
Go ahead, Lucy. Your thoughts on some of the points that Senator Bradley made.
Well, I just want to say that I think Senator Bradley is right that New Hampshire spent a lot of time trying to make sure its Medicaid expansion was consistent with its traditional maximizing its relationship with the federal government to do what's best for New Hampshire. And it was a public-private partnership, and we have almost 1 in 10 people have insurance through the marketplace, which includes our public-private New Hampshire Health Protection Program for adults who are poor. It's important to remember that many of them are working. When we look at the future, we need to be very, very sure that we are being thoughtful and intentional about what kind of shift is happening on our Medicaid population, because New Hampshire has traditionally been very creative with its relationship with the federal government. And we've gotten a lot of support for our employers, for our state. Millions of dollars have come in to help us address substance use, mental health, as well as help people actually get better and have doctors for the first time in a long time. So block grants are complicated. huge risk, and it will take a lot to convince me that they're the right way to go, given the partnership and the unique program we've just started in 2014 that seems to be working.
So we've heard a lot of people talk favorably about block grants this morning, Lucy. What's the huge risk that you see?
Well, let's not kid ourselves. A block grant is something that the federal government is supporting because it reduces the amount of money they can send to the states. So that's a given. And how do we as small New Hampshire, who've been very creative in the past, end up protecting ourselves and our citizens when we know that's the motivation from the federal government's point of view, which is to cut the resources that come to New Hampshire in a block grant? We've been able to retain a lot of responsibility. We've got a waiver going right now where the feds have given us a lot of flexibility to try and address mental health and substance use in our state. So we have to be extremely careful and negotiate with all of the expertise we can bring to bear if we're going to move into that kind of a system where there's a cutoff without any relief. And it takes a lot of discipline to implement a block grant for the best interests of those it's intended to serve, which are most needy in the population.
Well, and we heard Senator Bradley, who, again, really, really worked on this Medicaid program for New Hampshire and has been an outspoken supporter of the benefits that you mentioned, you know, substance abuse, mental health.
Absolutely.
Even he said, hey, block grants would be okay.
Yes, I think Senator Bradley would bring his experience and expertise, but you know that we need about 50 of him to be able to implement this well. I do think we have to be very careful about what's offered, because at the end of the road, it could mean New Hampshire has a lot less than we started with to help support our population.
I got to let you jump in there too, Jim. Lots of fears about block grants.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of understand the arguments on both sides. I actually do favor a per capita system that would ensure some flexibility based on enrollment. I do think that that probably allows for more of the protections that some people that worry about block grants would see. So I would be more in favor of the per capita thing. But the reason I'm in favor of that is I think the matching system has been basically a failure, that it's created a huge amount of distortion and waste in the Medicaid system. And if you move to something where there's more clear financial responsibility, both at the federal level and at the state level, and accountability for the performance of the program, things would improve. I don't think we should kid ourselves and say, oh, we expanded Medicaid and therefore all things are great. There's been scores and scores and scores of studies by the Government Accountability Office and others showing major integrity problems in the Medicaid program. And moving away from the matching system is critical to fixing that.
Let's go back to our listeners, both of you. And Paul joins us from Exeter. Hi, Paul. Thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning. How are you?
Fine. Go ahead, Paul.
Good. I just wanted to call with a real-world example. I own a one-man LLC. I've owned it for about 17 years. And I'm extremely healthy and basically almost never go to the doctor. And I had been buying an Anthem Blue Cross plan that was about a $5,000 deductible. And the premiums were going to go up to $550 per month this year. So I decided to take a look at the ACA, and I actually have picked up a plan for the same deductible. And I get all of my preventative visits covered now for only $450 a month. And I'm well outside of the subsidy range. So I'm an example of somebody who's done extremely well by making the switch over. And again, it's the exact same plan, same company, Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield, and the premium is $100 less per month. So I just thought it'd be useful to throw that out there to see if anyone can explain how and why that happens.
Thank you so much, Paul, for the call. Good to hear from you. And Jim, what do you think about that real-world example that Paul gives us?
Yeah, I mean, I don't doubt it's probably replicated in many different ways across many different people. I mean, there's a lot of idiosyncrasies going on in health insurance markets, and it could be that the pool of the participants in the probably a plan that was grandfathered and allowed to continue but wasn't compliant with the ACA, the pool of people involved in that may have shrunk so much that the premiums were going up. And therefore, going into the new pool associated with the ACA broadened the number of people that were in, and maybe that brought the premium down. I wouldn't be surprised if that something like that occurred in that particular instance.
Lucy?
Well, Paul, thank you for your story. I think that a recent study showed that there are more of you in New Hampshire than almost any other state, which is sort of sole proprietors, LLC owners, who have actually been able to find coverage on the marketplace that is affordable. I think some of it is that in New Hampshire, we've been able to we were in a real death spiral before in terms of who could actually get an individual coverage or a small group coverage and what the costs were. So some of that is the effort of everybody just trying to make that kind of coverage more affordable across the board. Providers really trying to work on value, insurers really trying to manage care well, and everybody trying over these few years that we've had the effort to make the insurance that we do purchase something that's valuable. It's difficult, but hopefully it was for you.
Well, last question for both of you, and I'll turn to you first, Jim. Negotiating the ACA took a long time. Getting it fully rolled out took 5 years. I remember doing programs, since 2010 on, okay, this deadline is now here, and now this part is going to go into effect, and so on and so forth. What's the likelihood, Jim, of a shorter time frame period for a replacement law? Or will it take another 5 years to get the replacement into place?
I don't know about 5 years, but it'll take a while. It'll take a couple of years to try to move things in a different direction. And so I wouldn't expect that the health system that we have in the United States is going to look very different a year from now than it does right now. It's going to take a while to make changes, and they'll have to be phased in fairly gradually.
What do you think, Lucy? Predictions?
Yeah, I think that what we really have to be careful about is trying to undo the investment we've made in this solution so that it costs more. I mean, every change costs our system, creates instability, creates confusion, and that's a huge cost to everybody. So I hope it takes time because we've just implemented this new experiment and we're starting to see some of the benefits.
Well, thanks to everybody who called and emailed. And by the way, our conversation always continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. So you can put your comments there if you didn't get on the air today. And Lucy Hodder, Jim Capretta, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
Yeah, you're welcome.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.